Imagine a world in which post-traumatic stress no longer robs from millions who suffer.
You don't want to get help because you're embarrassed. You don't want to tell people the dark stuff that you've went through.
That stigmatism of you can't talk to people is so true.
And I said, I don't want to live this trauma again. Right. And he goes, you don't have to. Yeah. And I said, what?
The experts, they forgot to tell me I can heal. I didn't know that I can get rid of PTSD.
I just remember being able to stand by the water and look up at the sky and hear the noises. And I didn't think they were gunshots. I was like, those are Disney fireworks.
I don't even know what to imagine for myself now, my future, because I have one.
This is Life After PTSD.
Welcome to another episode of Life After PTSD. And today we're going to revisit our second episode that we ever did, because here's some new information that we just wanted to add.
It's kind of fun. Dan Jarvis is going to be, part of today, and he shared his story in that episode. And so I'm really excited. This is a great one for not just military. This is especially great, I think, for civilians to hear from the perspective of military, because he's going to talk about some things that he saw, which, I mean, you and I, even just re-listening to this, we're going, he is so casual
and casually how he talks about that stuff. Suicide, and this one died, and that one died,
and not apathetic. Please don't get us wrong; it's not that at all. It's casual in the sense of, oh my gosh, this is the reality that these guys live in and that they experience on a regular basis, and it's so they're so accustomed to that. Man, it's nuts, and I don't think this. Maybe it needs a small trigger warning. I don't think it's bad. He really doesn't go into depth of, anything too specific, but I always want to be sensitive to, anybody that's out there doing that. But a very, very fun episode, to kind of revisit. Probably was recorded about maybe 2 years ago or something, give or take. And without further ado.
Let's do it. Let's visit this again.
Dan Jarvis, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thanks. Thanks for the invite.
Dan, this is a real struggle for you. This is you have lived this world. You have walked in the trenches of this world just as deeply as probably any have. And today we get to talk about your story. So tell me some things about you, man. You've got a military and a law enforcement background.
So I joined the Army initially back in 1988. I was 17 years old, out of high school, had to get parental permission. And of course, my dad was career Navy, and I thought I'd show him and join the Army. That was my act of rebellion. He took it a lot better than I thought he would. Went to Fort Benning, Georgia, the home of the infantry, got trained, ended up at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and was a M60 gunner, was a machine gunner. And I only did a 2-year enlistment with the Army College Fund option. I got out literally 3 days before Saddam invaded Kuwait. And I remember when the attacks started to occur, and everybody's like turning on the news, and that's the beginning. And then shortly thereafter, I get a letter, I got recalled to active duty. So at that time, at the age of 19, I was expecting to be going over to the Middle East. But the war ended relatively quickly. I was back out 6 weeks later and started my college back up and finished college and then became a deputy sheriff. So anyways, after 9/11, I kind of mulled around a little bit. And then 2004, I decided to go back in. We had just gone back into Iraq in 2003 and I did a 15-month deployment to Iraq. Out of Hawaii. I was with the 25th Infantry out of Hawaii. So we did it was initially a 12-month deployment, and it got extended during right before the surge. Our battalion, we were the Wolfhounds, the 27th Infantry, we lost 17 Americans during that deployment. And then we lost one interpreter for one of the companies was killed. We had a pretty significant, it was very kinetic fight, way different than Afghanistan was. They had the active insurgency. IEDs were just absolutely crazy and everywhere. Jeez. And we pretty much anytime we went out, we were getting hit. And I remember we were at a battle position outside of Huija, and we had just gotten intel that there was going to be a garbage truck IED or vehicle-borne IED that was going to target us.
Sure.
2 days later, we ended up having a dump truck coming in, trying to come into the back. We had a complex attack first, so we were receiving indirect fire from mortars, RPGs, machine guns, small arms fire.
Yeah.
And we're one platoon in a house. Yeah. We were probably in an undeveloped 5,000 square foot house. So, I'm in a truck with another gunner, and we're pulling security outside with a 50 cal.
Yeah.
And I just start hearing the incoming mortars, and they're just walking in closer and closer, and you're like, oh man, this is not going to be good if it hits this Humvee, because we had no armor on the top. It's all on the sides.
Yeah.
So the gunner said, "Hey, Sergeant Jarvis, they're shooting at us." I'm like, "Well, shoot back."
Yeah.
It's kind of like that line in Black Hawk Down, shoot back.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So sure. We ended up, you know, they had Kiowas come in, small arms fire. We had a young machine gunner who saw the vehicle coming, and he turned and engaged the dump truck. Hmm. And they, I mean, they were literally shooting around his position. I mean, the sandbags around him were just, you know, getting dusted up with rounds, and he never came off the gun. He continued to shoot, and then we were able to stop the threat.
Yep.
But you know, we ended up, it was a dump truck with full of gravel in the back. It had 1500 pounds of homemade explosives and about 400 pounds of propane. So
what's that capable of doing, man? I mean,
it would have leveled our entire building. When the explosives guys came out, they literally had to detonate it in three separate detonations because it was too big.
Wow.
So that's the kind of fight we were in. When we came back, you know, a lot of guys struggled, you know, we had DUIs just went crazy. Mm-hmm. Alcohol related events went crazy.
Sure.
And one of the things with post-traumatic stress is guys tend to self-medicate. So they'd come home and literally, like, you know, drink themselves crazy. So, you know, you have to try to understand what they're going through, but at the same time, the military, you can't break down the basic discipline level. So a lot of guys were getting chaptered out of the military. You know, we had one of the sergeants in our platoon, literally 18 hours after getting back to Hawaii, overdosed and died, had an overdose with on cocaine. And it was actually on the anniversary of the day that he was shot. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, we would deal with. We had a lot of accidents in our post-deployment leave. We probably lost two or three to accidents, and a lot of it was alcohol related. You know, guy was cleaning a gun goes off, shoots himself, you know, and then we start getting eventually into the suicides.
Yeah.
So a garbage truck and a dump truck, things that we see here all the time, could now possibly be triggers for PTSD.
It's so crazy that you point that out, because that didn't even cross my mind at first. I know it certainly didn't then, you know, when we recorded this, but yeah, I mean, can you imagine seeing one of those things? He's talking about, you know, enough explosives basically to level their entire company, you know, that was backing into their thing. Yeah, it's got to be interesting to wake up in the morning to hear the dump truck noise backing up on the, you know, garbage days or something like that.
Or how about just driving and seeing dump trucks or garbage trucks?
Yeah.
Or when you have kids, for people who come home from Afghanistan or Iraq and they have kids, and kids are so excited when they see trucks, right?
Oh, yeah,
look at the truck.
Especially a dump truck. That's like the coolest truck ever.
Right. And so now you have this trigger.
Yeah.
And then,
so speak to that real quick, because somebody's listening right now, and you know, that word trigger kind of gets thrown around a lot. What does that mean, right? Like, can you kind of give the audience a perspective on what, you know, a guy like Dan and his crew would have been experiencing coming back after something like that? Like, talk to that for a second. What is a trigger for them?
Well, a trigger for them is coming back and seeing anything that could remind their brain of something that could be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So we remember things that are bad, so that we hopefully don't step back into them again.
Right.
And remember good things so that we can keep doing them, right?
So the brain literally processed that event, associated that with, say, a dump truck, you know, and now it sees a dump truck in the future, and being super literal like that, it just says, danger, warning.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it could be anything. It could be,
right.
We don't have this so much in Florida, but in other states where there'll be a deer or an animal sometimes on the side of the road, that they use those sometimes to have explosives in. Mm-hmm. And so I've had clients that was a trigger for them, just driving by and seeing something on the
I've never done this, but if somebody's hit a deer before, right? I mean, can you imagine too, like, that just jumps out at you in the middle of the night when you're driving on a highway or something? Like, that would make night driving a very interesting experience thereafter.
Yeah,
right?
Probably.
Mm-hmm. So interesting that we all experience these, but crazy stories.
But then he goes on and talks about the DUI and ODing, somebody that ODs a year to the date that he was shot, I think is what he says.
Yeah,
right?
But within, what, 18 hours of returning
coming home.
Right?
And then somebody, an accident, a gun went off, and then you get into the suicides. And I'm thinking, this is all, he says this in just nonchalant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is just par for the course. This is what happens. This is what military, and for me, this is what they are dealing with. Mm-hmm. And this war has been going on since,
So I would ask the question though, Carrie, from your expertise, you've worked with a lot of military guys and certainly have interacted, you know, with them. if there's an audience member out there that's saying something like, but not everybody experiences that or something like that. Like I would disagree. Would you? I mean, because, you know, yes, maybe they don't all have a story like what Dan is telling here, but, you know, certainly they are trained for this. Their brains are being prepared for this, and they have other stories too.
Absolutely. And even if they weren't deployed, sometimes the guys who are left back feel bad because they hear about other people being hurt or injured, and they feel it's like the survivor's guilt, maybe not survivor's guilt, but being, you know, still on the state's guilt, right? Yeah. I wasn't there for my guys.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think this is the problem. For me, it was so overwhelming to think there are so many and we have no idea what they've really gone through. And most of them have not talked to their families about it.
Yeah.
They haven't told their wives. Their wives don't know why they're waking up at night or why they're checking the doors or why they react, you know, in a restaurant. Mm. They really don't understand it. And we just need to do something about it.
Well, I heard somebody say in law enforcement one time, a law enforcement officer talked about how they do their best to sort of like build a compartment that they put all that stuff in to keep their family shielded from it. I mean, I'm sort of paraphrasing, you know, the words there, but I can't imagine that being any different than these guys as well. And they're doing it for noble reasons. But that creates also difficulty within a family as well, because you have, you know, family members who clearly perceive, hey, this person is struggling right now. This person that I love very, very much. And, you know, I can't get through to them and I can't whatever. When in reality, the person that's sort of built this construct is thinking that they're doing the most noble thing ever. So it becomes this big sort of catch-22 that kind of becomes one big cycle that feeds each other. I mean, it's just awful. You know, and I don't know that there's necessarily a solution to this. I think part of this is just to encourage empathy and compassion, because quite frankly, you know, we thank God that I don't have to see some of the things that these guys see,
absolutely,
that they experience. Yeah. I mean, when we say that this is our country's bravest and finest or whatever, it's for this reason right here, because they have had to take on a burden that the vast majority of us would, I mean, can you imagine? Like I would be put in a room somewhere with padded walls. I mean, I couldn't.
Right. And as a clinician, you said something, you know, can you imagine? Unfortunately, I can't imagine because I've heard the stories.
Sure.
But I don't have to hear the stories anymore.
Right.
Right. So they can get through this trauma and not have to share their story, which is what I love about some of the therapies that are available now.
Yeah. And I believe Dan's going to talk about that. So let's get to that.
And I ended up going straight into another deploying unit. So I had about 6 weeks in Fort Wainwright, Alaska. And then we deployed to Afghanistan for a year.
Wow.
And I had no train up with my guys. So I literally got a brand new group of people. And we were, you know, boots on the ground in April of 2011.
So as a drill sergeant, you got a group of brand new people and then went to Fort Wainwright? Were you still a drill sergeant?
No, no. The drill sergeant duty was, we ran about 9 cycles. Each platoon had about 60 men in each platoon. So we continually trained soldiers, and it was a basic combat training. So we didn't really have any of the combat guys. The drill sergeants are required 1/3 to be combat arms or infantry because we're the ones that are the tacticians.
I just wondered.
Pause for a second here. So you're telling me as a drill sergeant, these deaths and suicides are continuing to happen. You're getting news of these in waves as you're a drill sergeant, yes?
Yeah, we actually had a drill sergeant who killed himself while I was at Fort Knox.
How do you deal with something like that at that moment? How are you expected to deal with it, I guess, is maybe a better question.
It's kind of one of those things. I mean, at the time I was relatively good. I didn't really have a whole lot of issues.
Yeah.
I did have a traumatic brain injury when I was in Iraq.
Okay.
And it took me a little bit of adjustment, but I finally came back to a normal sense after the Iraq deployment. And then, you know, of course, being a drill sergeant, every minute is occupied. So you really don't have to deal with anything. It's just, it's not going to come up because you're so engaged with training new soldiers. And then when you go back to war, you know, I can remember the first time we took any kind of combat action in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
We were having a leadership meeting with a squad leader's platoon sergeant, platoon leader, and I heard a noise in the distance. And it's like 5 years ago, I heard that same noise. I said, we're about to take contact.
Yeah.
And they looked at me like I was crazy. And then 10 seconds later, an 82-millimeter recoilless rifle round detonates maybe 20 feet from where we were, and it was right next to our soldiers' tents. And so everybody gets out, we're going to, you know, we heard we had a casualty, and as we're about to go into the soldiers' tent, RPG round detonates directly over, knocked me, one of the other squad leaders, and my platoon sergeant on the ground. And then we ended up, we had a medevac, two soldiers. One came back to us, and one didn't make it back to us.
This is right when you got back there?
This is May. We were probably in country 6 to 8 weeks at our forward operating base.
That's pretty
After the 2 years of doing the drill sergeant thing, right? Yeah. Unbelievable.
So then all of a sudden we're back into the thick of it. And then, you know, we took our first KIA in June. Yeah. We lost a sergeant from one of the other platoons. The striker hit an IED, and they had several that ended up being amputees that survived that event. Mm. You know, and these are things that just continue to cycle. And and within that fighting season in Afghanistan, we lost, in my squad, we lost four guys to combat injuries. They all got medevaced out of country. They didn't come back to us.
Yeah.
We had one of our soldiers that was killed in action.
Yeah.
And then I think all in all, we had seven Purple Hearts, to include myself.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
July, I was leading a patrol across the Tarnak River, and I had four Afghan soldiers, and there was four of us Americans and an interpreter. And I stepped on a pressure plate, which detonated an IED, you know, 5-10 feet away. And it was like a big old ball of fire just goes straight up into the air. And, you know, talk about getting your bell rung. It's kind of hard to, you know, feel sorry for some of these NFL players, you know, but, you know, it's a significant shock. And after that event, I had issues sleeping. Every time I closed my eyes and I'd go to sleep, I'd hear an explosion. The first 2-3 times, I'm figuring we're still under attack, or we're under attack. And then you realize, wait a minute, nobody's reacting. Something's not right here.
Yeah. Again, the casual speak, I mean, think about this, traumatic brain injury. Yeah, I had a traumatic brain injury. It's like, you know, it's interesting. Before, I remember the first time I heard the word trauma used in the context of, like, you know, say mental health. I always used to think of trauma. I think a lot of people probably admit the same, that, you know, trauma is like that car accident on the side of the road that you have to be airlifted to a trauma center or something like that. I never thought about it, you know, in terms of, you know, emotional, mental health and everything. But, you know, traumatic brain injury. Just for a second here, what's a definition of that? Can we kind of clarify that?
In layman's term, you get hit on the head. No, but no, according to the Mayo Clinic, brain dysfunction caused by an outside force, usually a violent blow to the head.
Yeah, blind, like it's like a sucker punch. I mean, it's like getting hit with a whatever, anything.
Well, he said it was a fireball. Yeah. You know, he said he doesn't have a hard time feeling bad for the NFL players, right? But it does. The problem is you can have immediate or delayed symptoms. And so this can go on for a really long time. Concentration gets difficulty, blurry vision.
Yeah, I was
going to
ask you, what
are
some of the symptoms that people experience? Yeah.
Confusion. Okay. Persistent headaches.
Like all the things somebody experiences when they have a concussion, like a or whatever,
concussion.
But it's like a prolonged concussion, basically.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So no wonder some of these guys are coming back and doing some of the crazy things he talked about. You know, I mean, I'm not making excuses for the behavior here, but man, again, it just highlights this is what our guys go through. Like they need some help. We need some serious attention, you know, to this problem. It's unreal. What else did you pick up in that segment there?
Well, just on the TBI, the other thing on this, even those who appear to have recovered fully can still have long-term symptoms.
Interesting.
That may never go away.
Interesting.
Or, you know, that's what they say.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I thought was interesting was the sleeping, right? Mm-hmm. That's so classic with PTSD. I had a client today in my office who, I was a couple and the wife has PTSD and she hasn't been sleeping. But she didn't realize that she had been breathing heavy and waking her husband up. She's just waking up really anxious.
Yeah.
And he said, well, in my office, he said, well, because you weren't sleeping. She's like, yes, I was. And
so he's already up and he's observing what
she didn't know that she wasn't sleeping. She didn't know why she was, you know, waking up. Now, some people do know and they do remember their nightmares.
But sometimes
even if you wake up with a nightmare, you go back to sleep and you don't know that you've had a nightmare. But
exactly.
Can you imagine? So he's waking up in the night thinking he's under attack. So you know how you feel when you wake up. You know, if you ever had somebody knock on the door really loud in the middle of the night, you know, you jump up, right? You wake up thinking you're under attack and then you look around and go, okay, something's really wrong. No one else is moving.
Right.
You're not getting sleep and you feel like you're a little bit crazy.
And when that sleep gets, you know, interrupted, I mean, I don't care who you are. If you're somebody that goes even just a couple of days without sleep, right, it turns the greatest people in the world into, I mean, I hate to say it, into monsters. I mean, they are.
Oh,
we cannot function without sleep.
It's
at all. And so the thought of these guys, like literally, you know, you and I have talked to people before that have shared their story and they've talked about, you know, they haven't had more than 2 or 3 hours of sleep in years. Like, I can't process that.
But the bad thing is a lot of them are sleeping, it appears, when they come back.
Oh, yeah.
They're sleeping all day, right? This, you know, they're taking the kids to school and coming back.
Well,
and going,
but is it a medicated sleep? That's my question. Is it some of that
Or is it just not, is it just really restless sleep, right? They're waking up and don't even realize it. So they're not having
If you've ever experienced that before, like even a couple of days of insomnia or whatever.
Yeah, you know me. I always get really, good sleep.
Yeah, but it's really, I mean, that's almost worse too. Like when you're there and you like, okay, so technically I've been in bed for 7-8 hours or something like that, but it was not.
No, it's absolutely, unproductive sleep.
Unproductive sleep.
Is horrible.
That's a good word.
And it affects you in so many ways.
Mm, good word.
3 weeks after that event, that's when we lost Doug. I was the lead striker truck commander, so I was a senior guy at the front of the convoy.
Yeah.
And it was our job to find the IEDs before the convoy got to it.
Sure.
And when I heard the explosion behind me, I realized, you know, I royally screwed up. And then at 9:36 that morning, on August 19th, 2011, the call came over the radio that we lost Doug. And just watching the medevac birds coming inbound, they evacuated two other guys from that striker.
Yeah.
And then we had to get the vehicles out of there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And while we were getting the vehicles out of there, they hit the same vehicle a second time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and it was like right in front of my truck. And I'm like, is this really happening?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And wow. We had a brief firefight after that. And, you know, we just kind of went from there. You know, the combat wasn't really my hard issue. The hardest issue that I had was at the end of my deployment.
Sure.
My I got Red Cross notification that my mom had passed away.
Huh.
Or actually, she had had a massive heart attack and that I needed to hurry up. She didn't end up dying before I got home.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, but this is a time frame. We're talking February of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really slept since July.
Sure.
So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, just fatigue and, you know, you don't really know what's going on. I mean, your body definitely keeps score at the cellular level when you put that much stress onto it,
mm-hmm.
and then you don't have time to process it. So after my mom's funeral, I go back to Alaska mm-hmm. and, you know, that's when everything started. That's when I realized, hey, you know, I can sleep. You know, it's unfortunately going to cost me a 12 pack of beer a day, especially guys. We have this John Wayne syndrome, you know, like we're this, you know, I'm a combat infantryman.
Sure.
I'm a non-commissioned officer.
Sure.
You know, I'm a hard charger. I was an in-your-face drill sergeant.
Yeah.
I'd already been a police officer by this time. So, I mean, I was a pretty, you know, I thought
tough
I was
guy.
A, I thought I was, exactly.
Right. I mean.
So asking for help was not really part of the equation.
Yeah. Yep.
And as a leader in the military, if we ask for help, it's a sign of weakness, or at least that's what we think. That's what we're perceive.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
You know, so a lot of guys, you know, that are in leadership positions in the military, it's so difficult for them to ask for help because that's a death sentence to a career.
Let's talk about your journey. So you come back from service. You're starting to figure out that the new normal is not a long-term normal, not something you can live with. It's going to have to change. Something's going to have to break here, but probably not a whole lot of hope at this point based on the experiences of others, right?
Well, you know, when I got to that 11-month time when I was home from Afghanistan, you know, the depression was so bad, the anxiety was so bad, it was like, you know, at the time I wasn't married. I had no kids.
Yeah.
I'm like, what, you know, well, I guess if that's it, it's been a good run, you know, because I kind of got to that decision where it would have been easier to take my own life than to ask for help. The night that I was considering taking my life, you know, I lived in a bottom floor apartment
mm-hmm.
and I had a high powered rifle and I heard those two little kids, you know, walking on their floor on my ceiling and realized that wasn't the way I could go out.
Mm.
So I passed out. Next morning, I get a phone call, and one of the guys, a young man named Corey Smathers, 22 years old, shot and killed himself that same night.
Gosh. Mm.
So after dealing with the memorial services from that and seeing how the other men were affected, I realized, you know, this can't be my exit. There's no way, because,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
you know, if I as a leader do that, then I'm giving permission to every one of my men to do the same thing.
Mm, good
and
word.
So, wow. You know, I just fought through it and just kept on going. And then I was eventually retired from the Army.
So you come back, you're back in Florida and
start working again.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I came back and I was still drinking and doing all that stuff. And then I realized, well, I'm going to go back I want to go back to the sheriff's office mm-hmm. and I go back to the academy. And, And I realize I've got to get my entire life back in order. You know, if I'm going to beat this, I got to, you know, I got to get my physical, my spiritual, my mental health in order. And, you know, I started going back to the gym, trying to eat better and slow down the drinking quite a bit. And went back to church. And then, man, when you start doing things to be productive in your own future, things start happening. I left the sheriff's office, was going to start a business with a buddy of mine, and it just kind of went south. And then I realized, oh, great. Now what? You know, and then not having anything to do, those little hamster wheels start coming back, and then all of a sudden the nightmares started coming back and the night sweats, and my wife would, like, you know, she'd calmly rub my back at night because I'd be jumping around, and she said I'd be yelling, and, you know, and so I, you know, she told me, she first asked, you know, hey, what did you experience in the military? You know, start, talk to me, you know. So I'm like, you don't really need to know. I mean, I didn't want to tell her. And then I did. I shared with her some stories, and then she's like, oh my gosh, you need to go talk to somebody. I, you know, she wasn't prepared for that. A lot of vets, we tend to think that everybody owes us something. You know, the guys will come out with a chip on their shoulder. And I really wish we could, like, curb that, because nobody put a gun to our heads. Nobody said, you're going to serve your country. It's not like it's Vietnam and we were drafted. You know, so, you know, we just gonna have to get over the fact that many people out there just don't really care what you did, but there are many that do still.
So first, I'm always amazed in hearing Dan's story first, that, you know, I've heard him tell it a few times, and just the commentary about hearing the footsteps above, and, you know, how, I mean, that's one of those nights where, yes, I wish there was a better alternative for him that night, but to, you know, drink the fifth or whatever it is that he did that night to pass out. You know, it saved his life, and it saved possibly the lives of kids above him as well.
Well, right? and even before that, what he talked about is he realized he could sleep again, right? As long as he had a six pack or whatever it was, alcohol, which is why there is such a pervasive alcohol problem in the military, because they don't know, they're not treating their PTSD, they're self-medicating and they're drinking, which is then a huge problem.
So he talked later on in the segment about, you know, how guys signed up for this and they need to not, you know, I mean, just as we ended that little
break.
He said
everybody owes us something. They think
we do owe them something. We absolutely do. Yes. We owe them our respect, obviously, and our honor, but we certainly owe them the best possible solutions and treatments that we can give them, right? And our empathy, for crying out loud, because, I mean, again, you know, for these guys, they're not, I mean, I'm sure there's an aspect of recreational drinking that's just being wild, right, that happens. But that's not what we're talking about here when you're drinking a fifth to go to sleep, to drown out
alone,
the pain.
Drinking alone to go
exactly,
to sleep.
Exactly, exactly.
Right. One of the veterans that is a friend of the show said to me one time, he was at the grocery store and he was wearing a Wounded Warrior or some kind of hat or T-shirt.
Yeah.
And the cashier said, oh, what? How are you wounded? And that is what not to say, right? Because he looks healthy, and a wound, an injury that's affecting your mind is often one of the worst injuries. I mean, I'm not going to put down, you know, there's so many injuries that are terrible, but something that no one can see.
Think about this example.
It's difficult.
When you have, you know, people that are, like, say, end of life care. I'm thinking, you know, if somebody that's elderly and they talk about they still had their mental functions or whatever. Like, that's the biggest plus, you know, because there are somebody that go out with, say, dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that, or other, you know, related things.
Yeah. Well, like we say, mental wellness is just as important as physical.
Well, I think, but what I'm trying to say is, by that argument, though, we really have kind of understood that, you know, even without some of the physicality that maybe somebody loses in towards the end of their life, you know, from aging or whatever, if they have their mind, that's still a beautiful thing. They're able to, because they're able to be in relationship with people.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, essentially, you're talking about, you know, some
no,
kind
you just
of,
said it, be in relationship with people.
Right.
Connect with people.
Yeah.
Right.
Which and is if something we can't you can't do, that, do when you're drinking alone and you're drowning out all of the horrors and pains that you're dealing with, you know, with a fifth of whatever, you know, it's just, I mean, my heart breaks when I hear this stuff. I mean, it really, really, really does.
And when you don't really know who you can turn to, you know, in the military, you don't know, you feel like it's a death sentence, which it may not be. I think the military is getting more and more.
Well, it kind of depends on who you're under, I guess. Right.
Probably.
I mean, you know, maybe who your superiors are and that sort of thing, you know, we've heard that with law enforcement guys as well. And firefighters, EMT or whatever, there are some some that we've talked to that have worked under incredibly supportive people that, you know, understand that operational readiness is a beautiful thing, but that guys also struggle because the reality, and gals, because the reality is when they see things that you and I don't want to have to see, it's a natural reaction to stuff. So it's just very interesting.
Well, I just attended a conference, just like 2 weeks ago. And one of the speakers is in the military, a female in the military, and she is a psychologist or works in some kind of psychology. Mm-hmm. And she runs a psychological performance enhancement division, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
And the guys come because the commanders will bring their whole team,
sure,
to do this psychological performance enhancement.
Yeah.
And you know, that's exciting to see that,
mm-hmm,
to see those kind of things happening. So I think those are the kind of things we want to happen. And it's right there, like on the base or right off the base is where she's doing it. And it's with the support of the military.
Yeah.
So, and she's doing some alternative treatments and the team is really excited, and they are, there's competition. Imagine this among the teams in the military about who, mm-hmm, can be.
See, I love this kind of stuff, and I love that we get to highlight some of these things on the show and sometimes even get to meet some of these people doing this stuff and telling their stories, because these things need to be mainstreamed, right? And this is really what it takes, because I just don't know that, you know, we're not at a place right now where those kinds of things are being highlighted as primary treatments or whatever. That's the issue, is what it comes down to. It's like, yes, there are all kinds of wonderful things that are out there that are happening, but they're very minor in a lot of ways in terms of the coverage that they get. And it's sad because, you know, but now I understand, you know, if they went mainstream, they would be overwhelmed. They wouldn't have, wouldn't have the support and the staffing, you know, to do the things that need to be done. But the point is there are people out there making great headway in, you know, the treatment of trauma and helping people get their lives back.
And right? That's what we want.
And that's what we want. And that's what we want to tell the stories of people that are doing that and tell the stories of people getting, you know, healing, which is kind of cool, which is part of Dan's story. So let's continue on with that. So you go through, you start doing some treatment. Your wife says you got to get some help, get some answers here. And what's the first step for you?
The first step for me was a difficult first step. That was even acknowledging or asking for, mm-hmm, help.
Sure.
You know, because, you know, I went where all my peers go. Most of them will hit the VA at some point.
Right.
And initially, they sent me to a counselor where I would get literally 15 minutes with this guy, and he used to tell me how miserable he was at the VA. I was like, who's counseling who, you know? We're good at boxing up our emotions because we just, especially as guys, we just put it away, you know?
Sure we do. Yeah.
We'll put it in the back of our head, and we'll deal with it another day.
Yeah.
Well, when that day of reckoning comes and it opens, Pandora's box comes out, mm-hmm, and then you're all of a sudden, you know, you have some emotions you haven't had in a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, and then my wife met somebody who, through him, he was a retired Army colonel.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Scott Mann. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me giving him a plug here. You know,
Scott Mann.
Scott Mann has an organization called The Hero's Journey.
Mm-hmm.
And what he does is he helps warriors find their voice, mm-hmm, to help them reconnect in, you know, a post-war society.
Sure.
You know, and when I finally learned how to tell my story, you know, that's when the healing initially really started.
Yeah.
So I met another friend through Scott, Diego, you know, and he explained to me what PTSD was in terms that an instrument could understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a memory problem. Memories are stuck in the front of your brain, your neocortex, and we don't process them. And by me not sleeping, by me self-medicating, you know, I never hit that REM cycle and it was never able to process the memories. So the memories are stuck in your short-term for immediate recall, for nightmares, for flashbacks, for intrusive thoughts.
Sure.
And I was like, well, that makes sense. If somebody had explained that to me, it's not really that big of a deal. So I go through some of the memory reconsolidation therapies, and it was a pretty significant relief. You know, it brought resolution. I mean, I did the EMDR, that's with, mm-hmm, the light. I got some relief on that. I'm not going to say I didn't, because I did. And then I did the other memory reconsolidation, and I got resolution on it.
Sure.
And then through Scott Mann's organization, there's another gentleman named Tom Padilla out in Albuquerque, New Mexico,
mm-hmm,
who's been working with a gentleman named Dr. Burke, Frank Burke, out in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm out there in Albuquerque, you know, and I meet Alan Canerva. He's their director of training.
Yep.
And So I said, I want to go through one of these sessions. And he goes, yeah, you want to do it today? I said, sure. He goes, you want to do it in 10 minutes? I'm like, yeah, sure. Why not? He goes, you want to do it in front of the class?
In front of the group?
I'm like, wow. You know, crowds don't really scare me, you know.
Yeah,
sure, yeah. Let's do it. And I went through the Reconsolidation Traumatic Memories Protocol. And in a 45-minute session, I'm looking at him like, what kind of Jedi stuff is this? Because the one thing that I had been dealing with that I really couldn't get past was my not being there for my mom when she passed away.
Yeah.
And I literally had a conversation with my mom in those few moments. And then the trauma of the emotion, the intensity of the emotion was no longer there.
It's gone. Yeah.
So I was like, man, that is just, you know, cool. You know, I'm like, this is cool. And then, you know, when you've experienced the things that I've experienced, and then all of a sudden you find the answer, I mean, you got to share the heck out of it.
Oh yeah.
You know, and so that's kind of what I do.
So it was very interesting. He talked about the journey of his healing began with being able to tell his story.
Right. And a lot of people do not need to tell their story for their healing to begin.
Right.
But of course, he was working with Scott Mann and that they empower warriors to tell their story, which is important.
Absolutely.
If that's something that's important to you, because other warriors are hearing, oh, wait, this is normal.
Right.
I'm not alone.
Right.
And that's there's so much power and connectivity. Right.
You know, and as I'm thinking about that, too, you know, like all of our stories are connected in some unique way. Right. You know, you think about his story that he was telling. He wasn't just telling his story. He was telling the story of the others that he served with, he led, you know. So I think that's part of that significance.
Lost their lives. And think about how many people that touches, right?
Yeah.
Children.
Oh, my gosh.
Grandparents and
I mean,
mothers
it's
and
a
dads
way to honor,
and sisters and brothers.
Essentially what it is. And so, you know, yeah, for many people, they don't necessarily understand a line like that. And I'm like, that's where that most likely is coming from, isn't it? But, you know, so then he can use that journey and certainly found, you know, better treatment. Didn't settle for the, you know, just drinking the cares away, knew that that wasn't a solution, certainly found he talked about some of the memory reconsolidation techniques out there. He talked about, I think, doing EMDR, ART, I think it got mentioned in there as well, maybe RTM for sure. I'd probably a worthy conversation just if somebody's listening to this as a standalone. Certainly we talk about this on the show all the time, memory reconsolidation, big, you know, believers in what that has been doing for people. But can you just kind of give the audience maybe a real quick crash course on what that's all about?
Sure. The amazing thing about our brain is how much it remembers, right?
Yeah.
And we remember things for a reason, right? We remember the bad things that happened so that we can be aware of the danger.
Sure.
And we remember good things so we can repeat them. But the bad things can sometimes get stuck in a loop, right? And so the memory consolidation, we used to think that memory was like a library where, you know, like a library where you just take a book out and you look at it and you put it back in, but the book didn't change.
Yeah.
Right. Now we know that we take a memory out and it changes just a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when we reconsolidate it, it changes just a little bit so that our brain understands it. Sometimes it can get more negative, right? And sometimes when people are ruminating over something that's happened to them, what was one thing turns into something much bigger and worse than it actually was. But also we can reframe it, we can reconsolidate it and change it to reframe it so that it feels differently. And often when we reconsolidate and just remembering going through it, we can see different things. It's amazing as I watch clients reconsolidate what has happened to them. They will suddenly, what was all negative, they'll suddenly start noticing the other positive pieces of that day or that event. And I'm not changing something, you know, but a warrior has died. That is horribly sad. But there may be other people that came around them that they had forgotten about. So it's a powerful tool.
Well, I mean, it
should be used more often.
Yeah, and apply that out though, and think about, you know, a lot of these guys that have survivor's guilt, or they've got a fear of doing, you know, treatment because they, you know, maybe because they feel like they've lost a lot of those good memories. You know, like the only thing they're aware of is, well, I just know that, you know, this guy was my brother in arms or whatever, and you know, but the memory that connects me to him is the day that I lost him or her or whatever, you know? And there's a fear there, I think, for many of them that they're not going to have good memories either. They don't, you know, they've not been able to access them for so long, I guess is maybe the better way of saying it. And the cool thing is it almost kind of feels like it's a cloud that gets lifted and they gain greater access in many cases to some of these good memories. And what a precious thing, you know, and that's gotta be awesome for you when you get to work with some of these people and they have these sort of results and, you know, then they get to, they start to remember some of those other details.
Well, absolutely. And I've had people say, I don't want to forget him. I want to remember how bad that was for him. And I say, do you think that person wants you to remember them by their worst moment?
Yeah.
And the other thing that sometimes people will say is, well, I don't want to forget the decisions I made there because I don't want to ever make them again. You know, so when something happened,
what do you do with that?
And well, I say to them, do you really think that thinking about it over and over and over is going to make you not, you know, that's going to be the one thing that you have to have?
Yeah.
I mean, we've all made bad decisions and we can choose not to make them again. We don't have to think about them over and over and over.
Right.
But for some, sometimes when it's been attached to a trauma, they think, oh wait, I don't want to be that person again.
Okay.
And so, I think there's a lot of, if they just step back and reframe the event, look at the event, and they have to do it. If they step back and take a breath and think, how would this person or this event be best remembered? Is it really serving me to have all of these flashbacks and nightmares? And, you know, I can't be with my child because of the children that I saw die. Mm. That's not helping anyone. Mm. And so do them a favor, do their family a favor and get some help.
You know, Carrie, these decisions that you talk about, like, I think most people on the outside would look at somebody's circumstances or story and they would kind of go, well, that doesn't match objective reality. And isn't that the reality of what this all comes down to, is that people have trauma that leads them to, you know, triggers or decisions that are made about their life and their belief structure in some cases that just effectively don't, you know, it's like they've been robbed or they've been almost like refiltered through a really weird filter called trauma, and it changes sort of their outlook and it changes decisions that they make and everything. And essentially you're just helping a person kind of restore proper decision-making and everything. Whereas everybody else around them can look at that and go, man, you're getting worked up over this. You've got this, you know, you've built up this narrative in your mind and everything. It's like what you get to do with somebody is kind of help them tear that down.
Well, I mean, yeah, because it will imagine, you know, if you can't sleep, like you said earlier and much earlier, you can't sleep. Mm-hmm. These traumas are impacting you. They really do need to be unpacked so that you can move forward.
Yeah.
You know, just so you can sleep again.
Yeah.
Just for that. And so, yeah, and you don't want to have to miss out on every firework event because it reminds you of something horrible.
Yeah.
You want to be able to enjoy that with your family and know it's just fireworks, right?
It's awesome. So, hey, let's bring this to a wrap. It's interesting. You know, I love obviously the work that Dan is doing now. He started the 220 nonprofit, and people can check that out and certainly helping military servicemen get help. But what are some other resources that you would have people connect with? You know, somebody's listening to this, whether they're military or they're civilian or whatever, you know, and they would want to, you know, maybe seek out some treatment. Maybe what they've tried before hasn't worked or something like that. Where would you direct them to? What are your thoughts?
You know, we will list in the show notes maybe some of the different memory consolidation techniques that are out there, and they can go visit those websites.
Yeah.
They can obviously come to our website, to our counseling center, and just keep listening to some podcasts. The most important thing is just know that there's hope. There is something else. There's more to what you're living with.
If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and give us a 5-star review and share it with your community.